Well, I don't know how you cope with suffering. I personally like the ostrich strategy of pretending it doesn't exist. Jade will tell you that I'm always saying, it'll be fine, don't worry about it. She'll also tell you that that's not very helpful. Someone in work just this Friday said that I have a habit of seeing the silver lining and missing the great big grey clouds. Some people, though, are the complete opposite of that, aren't they? I was reading a book to prepare for this sermon by my old pastor, and at one point he said, for some people, they think that life is like an onion. You peel it back layer by layer until there's nothing left but tears in your eyes. It's a pretty bleak quote, but some people feel like that. For some people, life is sad, because we live in a broken world. Some people struggle with chronic pain or eating disorders or their sexuality. Some people don't have enough money, they're homeless, or they have to go to food banks. Some people struggle with singleness, long-term, or maybe bereavement, and they feel lonely. For some people, life is difficult. But when life is difficult, where is God? Well, I'm hoping that Ruth will help us answer that question. So, what is the Book of Ruth about then? Is it a love story? Well, yes. Some people like it because it's a love story. Some people like it just because it's a lovely story. You noticed when you're reading Ruth that no one really does anything wrong throughout the whole book. It's lovely. But what's it about? Well, the Sunday school answer is obviously Jesus, and that is true. Everything in the Old Testament points to Jesus, and so does Ruth. It's about how God is preparing a ruler to redeem his people and give them rest. But it's interesting, isn't it? Ruth starts with, in the days when the judges ruled. And if you think of the days when the judges ruled, there were, you know, famous people like Gideon and Samson, or maybe Deborah. Maybe when you're reading the Bible, you think, they're not really much like me, though, are they? You know, I'm just an ordinary person. Maybe you see people seeing visions and hearing God speaking to them, and you think, what about me, though? Ruth is a book about ordinary people. And it shows how that God provides for seemingly insignificant people in the detail of their day-to-day lives. And in the first chapter, those lives are pretty difficult. The first few verses of Ruth show how Naomi's situation goes from bad to worse. You see, in the days when the judges ruled isn't some Bible Times version of in a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. It's referring to a specific place, a specific time in history. And if you have read Judges, you'll know that it wasn't a particularly good time. See, the whole of Judges is basically this big downward spiral as the people turn away from God, God judges them, they reluctantly call out to him and he sends a rescuer. But then it repeats itself, they turn away from God again and he judges them again and they call out to God again and it goes downwards and downwards and downwards. Until you get to the story in Judges 19 to 21, which is just terrible. Judges ends with a horrific story, and then you turn over the page and read, in those days when the judges ruled, and you think, oh no, where's this going? Those were days when, as the last verse of Judges says, everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So it's a bad time, isn't it? But it's also bad circumstances. In the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. This is obviously at the point in the spiral where God is judging his people. So it's a bad time with bad circumstances, but it's also in a bad place. So a man from Bethlehem in Judah, together with his wife and two sons, went to live for a while in the country of Moab. The man's name was Elimelech, his wife's name was Naomi, and the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites from Bethlehem, Judah, and they went to Moab and lived there. Now, that might not sound too surprising to you. I mean, if there's a famine, what are you supposed to do? Go into the next door country where there is food? Doesn't sound like a bad idea. But Moab isn't like France. This isn't just like going to the country next door. Moab was a country started by the incest between Lot and his daughters in Genesis 19. It was a country that had spent four whole chapters of the book of Numbers trying to curse Israel via Balaam. And just a few pages earlier in Judges 3 verse 14, we read that the Israelites were subject to Eglon, king of Moab, for 18 years. So it's a bit of a strange place to go and live. It's kind of like going to live with the enemy. And they didn't just pop there for a bite to eat. It says twice in those two verses that they went there and lived there. So we're in a bad time with bad circumstances, and we're in a bad place, a dark place far away from God's people and God's land. But then it gets even worse, doesn't it? Verse 3, now Elimelech, Naomi's husband, died, and she was left with her two sons. Not only is she in this place far away from God's people, she's now alone with two, presumably teenage boys to bring up. It's gone from bad to worse. But then it gets even worse. We get a little interlude where we're told that they get married, but then it goes downhill again. So verse 4, they married Moabite women, one named Orpah and the other Ruth. But after they'd lived there about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and Naomi was left without her two sons and her husband. She's not only lost her husband, she's lost both her children. This is as bad as you could imagine, isn't it? And it's not just something that happens in one go, like a short, sharp pain. It's something that happens over 10 years. 10 years of relentless pain. So these opening verses of the book set the scene in a really emotionally powerful way without any dialogue, which is quite unusual because the rest of the book of Ruth is almost all dialogue. It reminds me a bit of the opening sequence of the best Pixar film, Up, which is a really emotional story about this couple who lots of bad things happen to them, but there's no dialogue the whole time. It's really emotional. And you can sort of imagine the same thing with Naomi here. You can imagine Naomi and Elimelech, their happy family back in Israel, but then they get hungry and they have to head off into the dark, distant country of Moab. You see them trekking through, but you see them get there and they're a bit better for a minute. But then it cuts to Naomi by a graveside with Elimelech, 56, and Naomi's in tears. And then time goes on, Naomi's hair gets greyer, she's stooped over, she's got more wrinkles, and another gravestone appears, Mahlon, age 25, and there's another woman crying in the background. And then Naomi's hair gets greyer, and another gravestone appears, Chilion, age 26, and another woman crying in the background. It's just a really emotional opening scene for this book. And it makes you think, where is God? Because there's no mention of God, is there, in these verses? Where is he? He seems to be nowhere to be seen. Which I think is one of the main things we can take from these verses. Sometimes that is how life feels. It feels like God isn't there. It's normal for God's people to suffer. That's what happens living in a broken world. I think that's like 90% of the point of these verses, but I think there's something else we can learn. Because it seems that Elimelech's choice to leave God's place, the promised land of Israel, and go to Moab, just made the problem worse. The narrator is not really bothered about it. I think because Naomi's the main character in this story, and it would probably be an Elimelech's choice. But I think we can say that going away from God's people when you're suffering ultimately just makes it worse. You know, some people can be tempted when they're suffering in church to leave the church and go and live the Christian life on their own. And maybe it works for a bit, but ultimately it just makes us worse off. So, after this terrible suffering, we get a bit of good news in verse 6, don't we? When Naomi heard in Moab that the Lord had come to the aid of his people by providing food for them, she and her daughters-in-law prepared to return home from there. So where is God amid all this suffering? Well, maybe we need to reconsider our answer. God's not absent. He's actually where he promised to be, blessing his people in his land. It's Naomi that's missing. There is blessing, but it's in the promised land, and Naomi is missing out because she's gone it alone. So how should we respond then? Well, Dave referred to the prodigal son earlier, and Naomi kind of strikes me as a little bit similar to the prodigal son here. Notice he had left his father's household and gone to the far off country where he thought everything would be better, but then he realized actually it wasn't, and it was better back at home. Even his father's servants had food to eat. So what does he do? He makes preparations to return home. And that's what Naomi does here, isn't it? In fact, this whole chapter is about returning. Apparently the word return appears 12 times. It's kind of like repentance, isn't it? There's a little bit of hint of that. So, in verse 7, with her two daughters-in-law, she left the place where she had been living and set out on the road that would take them back to the land of Judah. I sort of imagine them here at sort of a border crossing between Israel and Moab, and they're sort of fumbling around in their backpacks trying to get their pockets and then trying to get their passports. And Naomi thinks, hang on a minute, how's this going to work? See, I don't have anything. If I go back to Bethlehem, maybe I can find some distant relatives who might give me a bit of food, but I can't support two young unmarried women. This is just not going to work, is it? So she says in verse 8 to her two daughters-in-law, go back, each of you, to your mother's home. May the Lord show you kindness if you have shown kindness to your dead husbands and to me. May the Lord grant that each of you will find rest in the home of another husband. And she kissed them and they wept aloud and said to her, we will go back with you to your people. But Naomi said, return home, my daughters. Why would you come with me? Am I going to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me, even if I had a husband tonight and then gave birth to sons, would you wait until they grew up? Would you remain unmarried for them? No, my daughters, it's more bitter for me than for you, because the Lord's hand has turned against me. At this they wept aloud again. You see here that Naomi clearly believes that God is punishing her, but she doesn't want to drag Orpah and Ruth into it. She thinks that if they go on their own, they will be okay. She knows that she has nothing to offer them in Israel. So they have a choice to make, don't they? Orpah and Ruth have to choose whether to go back home or to go with Naomi to join God's people in Israel. And Orpah makes her choice. Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye. And that's the last we ever hear from Orpah. Now, I think we have a tendency when we're reading stories in the Bible to decide whether people are goodies or baddies. But I don't think that's what we should do here, because there's a temptation when you see Ruth, and she's clearly the goodie, you think, well, Orpah must be really bad. But actually, she just does what's sensible. I'm sure Jay's mum would tell you that obeying your mother-in-law isn't the worst thing you can do. And it is sensible to go back to her family. Naomi can't support her. There's only a problem with what Orpah does when you compare it with what Ruth does. Because Ruth's response is amazing, isn't it? Then Orpah kissed her mother-in-law goodbye, but Ruth clung to her. Look, said Naomi, your sister-in-law is going back to her people and to her gods. Go back with her. But Ruth replied, don't urge me to leave you or to turn back from you. Where you go, I will go. And where you stay, I will stay. Your people will be my people, and your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord deal with me, be it ever so severely, if even death separates you and me. That's an amazing response. It's really eloquent. But it's a response of faith, isn't it? Ruth is joining herself to Naomi's people and Naomi's God. She even uses God's name, which is interesting for a Moabite woman. Which kind of makes you think, where did she learn about God? Well, it can only have been from Naomi, can't it? I wonder if sometimes we think, oh, I'm so miserable, I'm useless at telling people about Jesus. God could never use me. But that doesn't seem to be true. Naomi, in her bitterness, had clearly told Ruth enough about God for Ruth to trust him and to think, I can go to this foreign land where there's no hope for me because God is there. So if God can use Naomi to reach out to people, then he can use you too, however you're feeling. Ruth's response, though, is full of faith, isn't it? In fact, I was trying to find a similar character in the Bible who shows such great faith. It's actually quite difficult to do. It reminds me a little bit of Abraham. You know, in Genesis 12, where God says to Abraham, go from your country, your people and your father's household to the land I will show you. It's kind of what he's saying to Ruth here. Only Abraham had every reason to hope in God. God had already blessed him. Abraham was already a prosperous man. But Ruth, on the other hand, she had nothing to go on. No reason for her hope. I mean, look at Naomi. If that's how God treats his people, why would you join him? Abraham had a direct word from God. God spoke to him and told him to go, whereas Ruth, she only had second-hand promises relayed by Naomi. Abraham had to give up everything, didn't he? His country, his people, his gods. But he had a promise of getting something. Ruth gave up everything. She gave up her family, her country, her people. All for what? In her speech, you see that her life plan appears to be going to care for this old lady and then dying. That's all she was thinking she was going to get in exchange for it. So her faith seems to be even greater than Abraham's faith. This speech, she's pledging herself to God's covenant people. And she says, he will be my God. You know, that's how God forms his people, isn't it? He says, you will be my people and I will be your God. Ruth saying, he will be my God. In clinging to Naomi, Ruth is joining herself to God's people. So Ruth and Orpah had a choice at that border crossing between Moab and Israel. And we have a choice too, don't we? At some point, everyone has the choice to either turn back or to go and join God's people. And for us, it might look like there's no reason to hope, just like Ruth. I mean, if you look at Christians, you might not think they're wonderfully prosperous or blessed or happy. And you might not have any direct word from God. I mean, most of us don't. You might just have second-hand promises from other people. And you might have to give up everything. I mean, most of us won't have to give up our country. Although, I was reading a couple of weeks ago about an FOC church where some Iranian Christians got baptized, and they can't go back to Iran. They can't go back to their family. But they think it's worth it to follow Jesus. And we will definitely have to give up, maybe not gods as in idols that we bow down and worship, but anything that we put in front of God, we will have to give those things up to follow him. So it might be that, like Orpah, turning back and going to our family where everything's safe and comfortable seems like the sensible choice. But actually, like Ruth, faith is worth it. We can trust God's promises. We sung this morning, didn't we, that your every promise is enough for every step I take. And God promises that while we may be suffering now, he will bless us. Our motto text from a couple of years ago, Romans 8:28, says that I know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him, who are called according to his purpose. 10 verses earlier, Paul says, I consider that our present sufferings are not worth comparing with the glory that will be revealed in us. What about Jesus' promise himself? When Jesus was talking to his disciples about suffering, he then says in Matthew 10:31, so don't be afraid. You are worth more than many sparrows. Jesus promises that he does care for us, and we can trust his promise. Naomi is certainly convinced, isn't she? After Ruth's speech, in verse 18, she says, when Naomi realized that Ruth was determined to go with her, she stopped urging her. So, why doesn't the chapter end there? If you were filming a Disney movie, this would be the high point, wouldn't it? This would be the end of the movie. You know, the credits would roll and you'd all go out of the cinema happy. But that's not what happens here. You've got a bit more. The narrator must have something else to teach us. So, verse 19, so the two women went on until they came to Bethlehem. When they arrived in Bethlehem, the whole town was stirred because of them. And the woman exclaimed, can this be Naomi? Don't call me Naomi, she told them. Call me Mara, because the Almighty has made my life very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why call me Naomi? The Lord has afflicted me. The Almighty has brought misfortune upon me. Well, what do you make of Naomi's response? I don't think we should be too harsh on Naomi. I think her response is actually full of faith, with a slight downside at the end. See, Naomi clearly has faith and believes that God exists. She mentions him loads of times in this, which is not something we should take for granted. I mean, lots of people say that they can't believe that God exists because they're suffering. And if God was real, then suffering wouldn't happen. But not Naomi. She clearly believes that God exists. Some people then say, well, yeah, okay, God exists and I'm suffering. So God must not be in control of everything that happens. God must be in control of the good things and then the bad things just kind of sneak around behind his back when he's not looking. But not Naomi. No, she refers to God as the Almighty twice. She certainly thinks he's in control of everything that happens. We see that earlier in verses 8 and 9 where she prays that God would bless Ruth and Orpah when they go back to Moab. She doesn't think of God as just the God of Israel. She thinks of God as the God of the whole world. And also, in praying for Ruth and Orpah, she shows that she believes that God is good. And again, there's a temptation not to, isn't there? Maybe if we're suffering, we think, yes, God definitely exists, and God is sovereign. So God must be some sort of cruel tyrant. He can't be good. But not Naomi, no. She does believe God is good. She prays that he would bless Ruth and Orpah. She knows that the Lord is against her, but she still thinks he's good. And I think that's where the flaw comes in. She's full of faith, but she's also full of bitterness, isn't she? She seems to think that God is good, but not to her. She says, yes, God is love, but he doesn't love me. Yes, God is kind, but not to me. But the thing is, in what she says, you can see that that's not really true. It's almost as like Naomi doesn't realise what she's saying. Notice in verse 21, I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. I went away, but the Lord has brought me back. It's interesting, sometimes in our suffering we can be so laser focused on what's going on now that we forget that God has actually rescued us. See, Naomi had gone wandering off to the far distant country and God had gone and found her. Kind of like the shepherd in the parable this morning. He goes out searching for the lost sheep and puts it on his shoulders and goes home rejoicing. I went away, but the Lord brought me back. Naomi, in her focus on her suffering now, has forgotten that God has actually rescued her. And we can do that as well, can't we, as Christians? We can all say that God has rescued us. But sometimes we forget about that. And we think God doesn't love us. But that can't be true. But the other part of this sentence, it's just not true, is it? I went away full, but the Lord brought me back empty. It's like Naomi's looking back on her life with rose-tinted glasses, thinking it was all good back then, before God judged me, before God afflicted me. But she went away because there was a famine, because there wasn't enough food for them. She was not full. She was hungry. It's not true to say I went away full. But it's also not true to say the Lord has brought me back empty. Think of Ruth after her magnificent declaration of faith, standing behind Naomi as she wanders into town, and Naomi's there telling everyone that she's completely alone, empty, got nothing. Imagine Ruth standing there saying, hang on a minute. But suffering does that, doesn't it? We can be so self-absorbed in our suffering that we miss that God has actually blessed us. You know, Ruth was standing right next to Naomi and she doesn't seem to notice. Because Ruth is really the start of the blessing here, isn't she? And we see it a little bit in verse 22. So Naomi returned from Moab, accompanied by Ruth, the Moabite, her daughter-in-law, arriving in Bethlehem as the barley harvest was beginning. We're going to sing in a minute that, although the bud may have a bitter taste, sweet will be the flower. And this is the hint of that sweetness. It's interesting, isn't it, that in all of this chapter, we never get an answer for why Naomi's suffering. Naomi never finds out. I think we shouldn't expect an answer to why we're suffering either. It doesn't seem to really happen in the Bible. But I think we do get an answer to the question of where is God? God is rescuing, arranging, and blessing. See, he's already rescued Naomi, hasn't he? You know, I went away, but the Lord brought me back. But he's also rescued Ruth. God has used this situation to make an outsider part of his people. See, Naomi has gone out from God's people, and Ruth has clung to her, And Naomi's brought her back in. Which is kind of like what Christ does with us, isn't it? Christ goes out from God's people, finds us in a dark and distant land, completely separated from God. And then he joins himself to us. Yeah, he dies with us, he's risen with us, and he brings us back to join his people. So we cling to Christ, just like Ruth clung to Naomi, and that brings us into God's people. So God has rescued not just Naomi, but also Ruth. So God is busy rescuing, he's also busy arranging. The book of Ruth is full of these sometimes hilarious coincidences. This one, notice it, the chapter started with a famine, and they just so happened to arrive back at the beginning of the barley harvest. Which, if you know the events in the rest of Ruth, which I'm sure you do, you'll know is significant. It's not just a coincidence that that's the time they turned up, is it? God is busy arranging things to go exactly how he wants them to go. God is arranging brokenness for good. Which is kind of what he does. You could say it's God's MO. You know, it's like Joseph said in Genesis 50, verse 20, which was the memory verse at Buzz Club a few years ago. You intended to harm me, but God intended it for good, to accomplish what is now being done, the saving of many lives. God used all of the bad things that happened to bring about good. And that's what he's done with Ruth, and that's what he will do with us. It's just how he works. It's how he works in the gospel as well, isn't it? Now, that famous verse in Acts 2 when Peter's preaching, he says, this man was handed over to you by God's deliberate plan and foreknowledge. And you, with the help of wicked men, put him to death by nailing him to the cross. Jesus' suffering was terrible, but it was arranged by God and used by him for good, to save us. Because God is rescuing, he's arranging, he's also blessing. Naomi and Ruth turn up at the time of harvest. They're going to be blessed. So how should we respond then? When we're asking, where is God? Well, it's right to cry out with Naomi. We saw those Psalms earlier where David is crying out in his suffering, and that's what Naomi's doing here. That's what Job does, and that's not a bad thing. Crying out to the only one who has any power to do anything about our situation is not a sign of a lack of faith. That is faith. So we should cry out with Naomi, but we should also cling to Christ with Ruth. We should join ourselves to God's people. And we should trust that God is working everything for our good. This chapter ends with Naomi and Ruth not really seeing anything. They wouldn't have known, it wouldn't have been anything special to them that it was harvest. But we know that blessing was just around the corner. And for us, maybe we can't see any sign of blessing in our lives, but one day God will bless us. One day we will arrive at a great feast, a great harvest, a great celebration. And we'll see that all through our lives, when we thought God was absent, he was actually rescuing us, arranging blessing for the future. Well, we're going to sing this song that I mentioned earlier. It's number 256. It's actually one of my favourite hymns, strangely enough. It has some great lines in it about how God is working amid our suffering. Verse 4 says, behind a frowning providence, he hides a smiling face. Sometimes we might think that it's as if God doesn't love us, but he does. And one day we will find out. His purposes will ripen fast, unfolding every hour. The bud may have a bitter taste, but sweet will be the flower. Let's stand and sing number 256.